Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is author and film historian, Professor Joseph McBride. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, I'm always happy to be on your show.
It's always an honor to have you on the show. But today is extra special because we're talking about a subject that I imagine is very close to your heart. We are here to commemorate the 100th birthday of actor, director, magician, raconteur, Mr. Orson Welles. Welles was born May 6, 1915. He's best known for writing, directing, and starring in what many consider to be the greatest movie of all time, Citizen Kane. However, despite being known almost exclusively for Kane, and maybe one or two other smaller Hollywood films, Welles actually had a long, storied, and surprisingly fruitful career as a filmmaker long after he left Hollywood. On today's show, we're of course going to celebrate the entirety of Welles' extraordinary body of work, but we're going to focus primarily on his long-lost masterpiece that movie lovers are finally going to get a chance to see, finally, hopefully, The Other Side of the Wind. So, Professor, what is The Other Side of the Wind, and why are people so excited about it?
Well, I've been involved with this film myself for 45 years. I'm in the film. It's Welles' take on Hollywood and the film business, which automatically is an important subject for a filmmaker to do his testament film about his own medium. And he shot it from 1970 to 1976, and it derived from an earlier project called The Sacred Beasts, which he started writing very significantly right after Ernest Hemingway killed himself in 1961. And he told me when I met him in 1970 that he had modeled the character of the old director on Hemingway, with whom he had a long, complicated relationship. And Hemingway's suicide was a big shock to everybody. I remember I was leaving a Milwaukee Braves game with my father in the car, and we heard it on the radio, and I'd never heard of Hemingway, and my father said, oh, he's the world's greatest writer, and this is terrible. What this film is about is this old director played by John Huston is making a comeback in the modern Hollywood of the crumbling studio system in 1970, what we now call the Easy Rider era, which was when the young filmmakers took over and Hollywood didn't know what to do anymore. They were failing with their old-fashioned kinds of films they were making, the big-budget musicals and things. And so they turned over the keys to the young guys. And Easy Rider was a huge hit, and a lot of youth pictures came out. And it was a fertile period for films, and a lot of garbage got made, but a lot of good films, too. And Chinatown was one of the great films that came out in that period, 74, and Godfather films, and, a lot of important young filmmakers started then, but the old people felt displaced and bitter and frustrated. So this old guy is trying to make a radical chic film full of sex and violence like the young people are making. And Welles imitates, there's a film within the film, so it's two films in one, as he said. It takes place at the birthday party for Hannaford, who's 70 years old, and Lily Palmer, who's sort of playing Dietrich, who turned down the part, is holding a big birthday party for Hannaford to introduce him to all the young people in Hollywood and the media, and they're showing parts of his unfinished film so he can get publicity and money to finish his film. And so obviously that's a theme that's very familiar to Welles because he was having trouble finishing his films and getting money, and he was feeling resentful. He wrote an article around that time in Look magazine, which I found baffling at the time. They asked him to write about the new Hollywood, and they thought he would write something, isn't it wonderful, the studio system is crumbling and now anybody can make a film. And he wrote this very bitter, angry article about all these young guys making films, and he said there was this cult of the director who reminds me of Mussolini. He thinks there was something fascistic about glorifying the director. And he said when he sees a director on a crane in a photograph room, reminds me of Mussolini on his balcony. And I finally understood that article many years later. What he was upset about was that he was a guy who had all these great films behind him, and he couldn't get a job in the new Hollywood. And some 22-year-old guy who had never made a film comes in and gets $1 million to make a film, and he really resented that. And what he realized was the fact that he had a track record was what was held against him, because he had this complicated series of films that were commercial failures or critically derided or whatever. So he was in this kind of strange state of mind, and also he was upset that people like John Ford and Howard Hawks were having trouble making films.
Right.
So that's what this film is about. But I was on the set with Richard Wilson, Welles' longtime aide, was there, and he said, "Orson, what is this movie about?" And Welles said, "It's an attack on machoism," which we really call machismo. So what it is at root, it's a sexual story. A lot of Welles' films really are homoerotic, in my opinion. They're about two men who love each other, and one destroys the other, betrays the other. So Hannaford in the film is this ladies' man, he-man guy who, as Welles told me, seduces the leading lady of the film or the wife of the leading man. But he said in his old age, the mask drops of the Don Juan, and he falls in love with the beautiful young leading man, played by Bob Random, who looks just like Jim Morrison. Interesting casting. And he wants to possess this guy, and he's in love with him, but it's a love-hate kind of thing, and he treats him badly, and the guy walks off the picture naked while he's filming a sex scene. He walks down the street of the studio naked, and Hannaford can't finish his film because of this guy who he abused. And so that's part of the story, that the old man reveals his latent homosexuality. And I think Welles was needling or exposing Hemingway. And I think it all traces back to an incident in 1937. Hemingway made a film called The Spanish Earth, which was a documentary about the Spanish Civil War with Joris Evans, who was a left-wing filmmaker. And they wanted Welles to narrate it, and he did. And they had a screening for Hemingway, and Welles was only 21. And I've heard Welles' narration. Hemingway started saying things like, it sounds like a cocksucker swallowing. And Welles and Hemingway apparently got into a fist fight in front of images of people dying in Spain, you know.
And, wow.
But then they kind of made it up, and they went out and got drunk.
Okay.
And they became friends. But so I think Welles was harboring a resentment of this incident, so okay, he was going to expose Hemingway as this, you know, and it is a psychological truism.
So it's less of a tribute to Hemingway, more of a
expose.
Takedown. Okay, expose,
yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, I mean, Welles thought Hemingway was a great artist, but you know, not a particularly admirable human being.
Yeah.
And
certainly, an attack on machismo. that wouldn't qualify as any kind of tribute to
no, it's an expose of Don Juan's.
Yeah, yeah.
Who, and, you know, it's a psychological truism that if somebody who's a Don Juan is a latent homosexual. And that's what the film, I think, is about at root. And
okay,
a lot of Welles' later films were about sexuality and, to some extent, homosexuality and also heterosexual sex. There's a great sex scene in a car that's the film within the film, the best scene I've seen. So Hannaford is making this kind of dirty movie, in a sense, as Welles put it. And Welles said to me, you know, I've always wanted to deal with sex in films, but I've always been too embarrassed to do it. And this way I can do it under somebody else's name.
Someone else is making this movie.
Somebody else made this movie. And his work before he met Oya Kodar in 1962 was kind of prudish and puritanical, in a sense, in terms of sex. If you look at his films, they don't deal very directly with sex. But after that, there's a whole flowering of sexuality in his later films, like The Immortal Story and F for Fake, and a lot of films deal with sexuality and nudity and eroticism, you know?
Right, yeah. In The Other Side of the Wind, from the clips that I've seen, haven't seen all of it, it seems like Welles was experimenting with quicker cuts.
Oh, yes.
He's primarily known for long takes. I mean, especially, you know, that opening shot in Touch of Evil, and then the other 8-minute long scene where he doesn't cut. So this is sort of a departure for him, right?
Well, he changed his style when he went to Brazil to do It's All True, mm-hmm. where he was making a documentary with non-actors on location. And when you have non-actors, you have to do short takes because they can't handle a long, sustained scene like a professional actor. And also, when you're on location shooting documentary, you tend to do shorter shots, and he didn't have a crane, he didn't have tracking shots, etc. So he evolved a new style as early as 1942, and then he goes back to Hollywood and he uses some longer takes, like the murder of the king in Macbeth is a 10-minute take. It's tremendous. But then he goes to Europe, and Othello is full of short shots. He didn't have the technical resources of the crane. I mean, he told me this, that I said, why did you change your style? He said, well, I didn't have the crane. I didn't have these technicians that they have in Hollywood and all this stuff. And Touch of Evil has long takes besides the opening shot. But most of the films he made in later years were montage films with short shots, and The Other Side of the Wind is like that, although the film within the film has some beautiful, it's 35mm, beautifully photographed, very pretentious, very arty. It's a spoof of Antonioni, and I realized only years later he's actually spoofing Zabriskie Point, which Antonioni released in 1970 and had come out just before Wells started Other Side of the Wind. And it's very similar to the plot of the film within the film. It's about radicals, young radicals, and there's violence, and there's an orgy and things like that.
I love that Wells decided to target Antonioni.
Yeah.
This is what's wrong with new film, with modern filmmaking.
Yeah, he hated Antonioni. He thought he was pretentious, and he didn't like scenes where nothing happened or where people were wandering around. But actually, ironically, I didn't like Zabriskie Point when it came up, but I saw it again recently at the Pacific Film Archive, and I thought, oh, this is a good film. This really captures the period well. My objection at the time was the two young characters had no affect. They were non-actors who were kind of blank. Mm-hmm. And now I realize that a lot of the radicals of the time were like that. They were kind of zombie-like, and so it captures that, and it captures a lot of the feeling of the time. I think it's a pretty good film. Mm-hmm. But Wells really didn't like it, so he's spoofing it. But the framing story of Other Side of the Wind is shot cinema verite, mostly 16mm. And he's kind of spoofing the cinema verite style of loose filming with the camera kind of wandering around trying to find the image. Like when I was on the set, he would say to the cameraman, how is your pan? And if the guy said very smooth, Wells would do it again, because he wanted the cameraman to be searching for the subject and that kind of roughness of cinema verite. Mm. So as Jonathan Rosenbaum said, this is a Wells film that has two styles of filmmaking, neither of which is Wells' own style,
right.
Which again, will confound people. Not everybody's going to like Other Side of the Wind. As a lot of Wells' films, when they first came out, they were misunderstood, and it took a long time for people to appreciate them. This one will have the same reaction. However, if this had come out in 1972, let's say, it would have been really groundbreaking, because people were not doing those super fast cuts back then. Later, MTV kind of pioneered that, and a lot of filmmakers imitated. Now it's very common to have a film with two-second cuts and everything.
Right.
But Wells was ahead of his time. Effer Fake has some of that fast cutting.
Right. Yeah. It reminds me, from what you're describing, it sounds kind of like All That Jazz. And he uses some quick cuts.
Oh, yeah. And All That Jazz is also, you know, about a director. And it's kind of a homage. And there are sort of films within the film and things. And that's true. That's a good connection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a double feature in the near future, if it comes out.
I think it might overwhelm you to watch both of those films together. But I'm very happy that this film is finally, you know, a deal has been made by some European producers who... I made a deal in 1999. Gary Graver, the cameraman, and I, we spent a lot of time trying to raise funding. We finally got Showtime, the cable network, to do the film. And we made a deal for $3 million to finish the film. And I was going to be one of the producers, and Peter Bogdanovich was going to do the post-production. And then the minute we made the deal, Oya Kodar and Peter fired me off the project, figuring they didn't need me anymore. And this was unfair, but I just figured I don't want to cause any trouble for this film. I just want to get it out. So I just bowed out of this whole procedure. So I'm not involved anymore. Although I've given people advice over the years, like when the producers who are now doing the film first got into it, they called me and I gave them the whole history of the production and gave some advice and things, and I've been advising them, and they told me that when the film gets farther along, they're going to call me back, along with some other people and, you know, critics and scholars, to advise them on the final form. Because what they're doing is editing a Wells film without Wells being here.
Right.
And it's complicated because he was always changing his films and changing his mood. And if he were here today, who knows how he would edit that film.
Right.
So there are some issues involved in how to finish it that are complicated. And I wrote about them a lot in my book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles. And I reproduced a memo that I wrote to Showtime talking about these issues. And it looks like things are going along. I'm always kind of crossing my fingers on this film.
We shall see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I failed to mention in my introduction, but you mentioned that you are featured and you are an actor in the film. So can you talk about your role and how you landed the part?
Yeah, that was a Walter Mitty kind of fantasy thing.
Yeah.
I'd almost finished my first book on Welles in August 1970, and I was working on a book on John Ford, and I went to Hollywood to interview John Ford, who is my favorite director, and I had no idea that Orson Welles was in the country. I always thought he was somewhere in Europe, and you didn't really know what he was doing. And so but I wanted to meet Peter Bogdanovich, who I had seen Targets, his first real feature, which was a terrific film. And he was doing the kind of thing I wanted to do, which was interview directors, which I was already doing. And then he became a director, which I wanted at the time to do. And so I wanted to meet this fellow. And so I went to Larry Edmonds bookshop in Hollywood, and I asked for his address, his phone number, and the guy there knew him. So I called Peter, and he said, I'm on the other line with Orson. Would you hold on? And I thought, wow, my God. So he came back, and he said, Orson would like to meet you. And this was all mind-blowing because I had no idea Orson was in town, and the idea he wanted to meet me was amazing. He said, call him tomorrow at 5:30 at this phone number. So I called him the next day from Schwab's drugstore, like in Sunset Boulevard, you know. And he first thing he said was, we're about to start shooting a film. Would you like to be in it? And again, I was amazed because I had never acted in a film, never acted at all, unless you count being an altar boy for 3 years in Catholic Church, which is a form of theater. It's a very Bressonian form of theater because you speak in a monotone and you do the same lines over and over again and your back is to the audience and you don't have any expressions. So all I could think of saying was something really stupid. I said, is this going to be a feature-length film? Because I couldn't imagine me being in a feature. I thought maybe it'd be some kind of weird short or something. And he laughed and said, well, we certainly hope so. And it turns out that was a good question because it's still not a feature-length film, and let's hope it is. Because some people thought we shouldn't finish it. We should use the footage Welles edited 41 minutes and build a documentary around it with snippets of the other footage. But I was always in favor of finishing the film because he shot all but a couple shots that they're going to have to imitate.
Right.
But anyway, so I went to Welles' home. And I had met Bogdanovich in the interim. And I also met Jean Renoir that weekend. So
busy weekend.
My three favorite directors.
Goodness.
And I thought that this every week in Hollywood was going to be like this. And I didn't realize this was the pinnacle of my Hollywood experience that week. And by the end of it, I was in an Orson Welles film. I spent the Friday afternoon talking to him about all kinds of stuff. And then on Saturday... I should say one reason he knew who I was because I'd been writing articles about him taken from my book and publishing them in film magazines. And I would send them to his lawyer because I didn't know how else to get it to him. And the lawyer was actually passing this stuff along to him. And I did a book called Persistence of Vision in which I ran some articles on Welles. And he had the book up on his mantelpiece. And he said, finally, I get to meet my favorite critic, which was very flattering. And
yes.
I said, why am I your favorite critic? He said, you're the only one who understands what I'm trying to do, which I thought was very nice.
Wow.
And he had been reading these things, so he knew that I was simpatico and everything. And
how old were you?
I was 23.
Goodness.
And I just met John Ford, and this was just a dream come true. So anyway, I was in this film, but since I had never acted, it was all new to me. And Welles liked to put non-actors... mix them in with regular actors. And he had directed non-actors, and it's all true, of course. So what he was doing was an experiment. And he there's a documentary you can watch that he did in the 60s where he talks about the film that became The Other Side of the Wind. And he said, I want to do an experiment because we've been doing films the same way all along, and I want to do something different, which is to have a cast of people kind of playing versions of themselves or personages. They have to be personages who can play themselves. And I will tell them what the scenes are about or what the story is about, and they're going to kind of make up their own dialogue and see how that goes. And so what he did with me was before every scene, we would talk for an hour or so, and he would ask me what I would say, and then he would alter it and then type it up, and then I'd have to say it exactly the way he wrote it, and I'd have to hit the marks exactly. There was no room for improvising. And since I was a non-actor, I couldn't really improvise. I tried once to do, like, I rubbed my nose in some scene. I thought that was the height of improvisation. And Wells said, "Cut, cut, what are you doing? What are you doing? I didn't tell you to do that." You know? So I was very intimidated, and he was bullying me a lot. I have a tape of the first day of shooting, and he was actually quite nice, and I was doing my lines well, and, you know, everything was fine. But then over the years, he started bullying me more and more. I think he wanted me to be intimidated because the guy I was playing was this young film critic model than myself, and I played him more naive than I really was, kind of wide-eyed innocent. And I was following John Huston around asking him silly film buff questions, and Wells was having fun writing them because he thought that a lot of the interviewers were asking stupid questions. And part of the point of the film, he said the media are devouring this guy, that he's surrounded by the media and he's swallowed up by them, which is a very modern theme. But anyway, so I follow Huston around asking questions, and he blows off most of the questions, but I had fun writing them with Wells. So it was my first chance to help write a script with Orson Welles.
Yeah, that is insane.
Yeah, but I had to be his slave as an actor, and I was willing to do that because I was very humble because I wasn't an actor. I thought I will be putty in his hands and do whatever he wants. And
right.
He would often give me line readings, and he would always preface it by saying, "It's terrible for a director to give an actor a line reading, but..." And then he gave me the line reading. I was grateful because I didn't know sometimes how I should read these lines, and
right.
he showed me how to do it. And so he was very good. It was like training. It was like my film school to be in this film. And also around it, we would shoot 18-hour days, and sometimes I'd be on camera only for a few minutes during a day. But I was in 45 days of shooting over 6 years. We kept getting called back, and I had dialogue every day. And
in the meantime, you've been writing books and...
Yeah, and I was working for Variety.
Yeah.
And I was getting older. I was aging, and I put on a little weight. And the first time I came back on the set after a year, he said, "My God, he's matured." And so he told me to wear, not to shave when I was in scenes, because he said it would make my cheeks look hollow and make me look thinner.
Yes.
Which was a trick he probably used when he was younger. And so it's kind of strange because it all takes place on one day, and I'm aging from 22 to 27.
Right.
I think
we'll see if it works.
It's a little like Boyhood in a
strange
way, except it all takes place on one day.
Right.
You know, it's kind of, I just realized when I was watching Boyhood, this seems familiar, and I said, "Oh, yes."
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was a great experience, and he directed me, you know, again, like just molding my performance, but... It, in some ways, it was more interesting to watch him direct some of the other actors, because he, one of his secrets, and this is true of all great actors, directors, I think he's the best, is that he treated everybody differently. He didn't just have a formula for yelling at people. And, for example, John Huston, who's his peer, and he's not about to, you know, yell at John Huston or correct him in front of everybody. He had to handle him differently. So there was a scene where Huston arrives at the party with this blonde teenager who was in the film Bogdanovich's girlfriend, and Hannaford appropriates the girl in a crude sexual power play, which was kind of a spoof on Sybil Shepherd.
Mm.
So he walks in with this girl, and Hannaford is supposed to leer at, or he's supposed to cast a kind of a leering eye on her at this party in front of all these people, but he overdid it. And I could tell that Huston was acting too crude in the scene, you know, and I was wondering, okay, how's Wells going to handle this, you know? So they stopped, they shot the scene, and Wells paused, and he thought for a couple of minutes, and then he said, "John," he said, "you know who you remind me of in this scene?" He said, "Oh, who, Orson?" He said, "Your father, Walter Huston, great actor."
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, really, Orson, why?" He was very delighted that people mentioned his father. He said, "Because he had that kindly paternal air, but nobody ever had a higher score." And Houston was delighted by this reference to his father as this old fox, you know. And so he played it that way with this kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek attitude, kindly paternal air, but still a lecher. And it was subtle and it was funny. It was just right. And I thought that was a brilliant piece of direction.
Yeah.
And it did not embarrass Houston, but got the point across without saying, do it this way. So that's a great example of Wells handling people with great psychological insight, I think.
You know? Right, yeah. So it is Wells's centennial birthday. How do you think he would have liked to have been remembered?
He used to deride the idea of posterity. He said posterity is like the boneyard, and, you know, it's not something I think about. But, you know, he was an artist who wanted his films to live and be seen, and he might try to disparage it, but I think he would be happy that we're looking at his films and having retrospectives. And I mean, I think in a strange way, there are many reasons a lot of his films were unfinished. A lot of it was just financial problems, and he was a bad businessman, and he was juggling different projects. And, you know, I mean, there, as I say, like in the Renoir film, Rules of the Game, he says, the terrible thing about life is that everyone has his reasons. And I think the terrible thing about Wells' unfinished films is each one has a different reason for being unfinished.
Yeah.
But I think in a strange way, he left them unfinished partly so we would be working on them and continuing his career.
Right. There's like, still stuff to dig up all these years later.
Yeah, Gary Graver used to tell me years after Wells died, he said, I'm still working for Orson. And he wasn't joking. He was literally running around town doing stuff for Orson. And so I'm not doing this film anymore because I don't want to be directly involved, although I will advise. But I'm writing about him. I'm helping rediscover some things. I'm interpreting his works. Other people are doing the same thing. James Naramore is another critic, Jonathan Rosenbaum, people like that. And the new books are coming out. But people are working on his films, literally restoring and polishing, you know, doing versions of Too Much Johnson, and then they're working on Other Side of the Wind, and there are other unfinished Wells films. The Munich Film Museum has put together short versions of, like, half-hour versions of The Dreamers and The Magic Show, which there's more of The Magic Show that could be finished. And he had other projects. Don Quixote is the other big Wells film that hasn't been finished, and it's scattered in different archives, and nobody has stepped up to the plate. There was a terrible version in 1992 that was put together with a bad work print, and they mixed it up with a documentary Wells made on Spain. It was just awful. But the footage is beautiful if you see the well-preserved footage, but it's in about three or four different places, and that needs restoration. Jonathan Rosenbaum said he thinks that's the great unfinished Wells film.
Really?
Not the Other Side of
the Moon. Oh, my God. He's always a contrarian.
Yeah, he's a contrarian. But well, it'll be interesting to see what people think of the Other Side of the Moon. As I say, a lot of people won't like it or won't get it. And it has a radical approach to style, telling two stories at once, which could be off-putting for some people, but it's an experiment, as Jonathan said, a new form of narrative. And it's a question how much emphasis the film within the film should have, which is not a decision for me anymore, but it's for the people working on it. But like every Wells film, it will confound people. They'll say, what? This doesn't look like Citizen Kane. This seems like a different guy made this film. And as Jonathan says, two different styles of shooting, neither of which is Wells's. And then some people won't like some of the themes. But other people will find it fascinating, and it's Wells on filmmaking and all these. John Huston gives probably his greatest performance, even better than Chinatown.
Wow.
I mean, he's the lead in the film, and he's fabulous in the film. And a lot of wonderful people. Norman Foster, who was a crony of Wells and a director, worked on It's All True. He gives a terrific supporting performance. And so it's full of riches,
yeah,
and beautifully shot by Gary Graver, and full of commentary on Hollywood. It's in, you know, like Sunset Boulevard, it makes kind of critical and acidulous comments on Hollywood, but it's full of a love of filmmaking as well. It's a complex, very complex film.
Right.
And then it deals with these sexual and gender issues that are very modern.
Well, so hopefully our listeners will have an opportunity to see the finished product. But if not, there are plenty of other Wells options to choose from. So find your own way to celebrate Orson on his birthday.
Yeah, go to, if you're lucky enough, go to one of the retrospectives or conferences. But if not, just do your own by going on Netflix and other places you can rent or buy the Welles films. A lot of Welles films, like Othello, is coming out from Criterion. There was a French restoration of Othello, and Macbeth came out in November 2014. I did a 45-minute interview about Othello. And so things like that come out. You can see a lot of the films on DVD or Blu-ray now.
Exactly. Have your own little retrospective.
Yeah, you can do that very easily now. And the hard part, though, is that some of the unfinished work is hard to see unless you're in Europe. Those films that have been put together by the Munich Film Museum, they haven't shown them much in America. And like, they had a retrospective at the Cinematheque in L.A., and very few people turned up.
What?
You know, people need to be proactive.
Exactly.
And but, you know, it is unfortunate that these things are not all available. Like, right. All of his unfinished work should be out there, but there's some legal issues and it gets complicated. But, you know, there's Welles' Shylock. There's a wonderful compilation of Welles playing Shylock in different media that the Munich Film Museum put out that's really terrific. And The Dreamers is a beautiful film. It's he didn't finish it, but 27 minutes of it exists, and it kind of tells the story, and it's really haunting and beautiful.
All right. Well, again, people 100 years old. So
he's the youngest 100-year-old
exactly.
guy we know.
All right. Is there anything else you wanted to add? Or
no, I think just I think you made a wonderful suggestion, which is have your own Welles retrospective and just keep watching these films, because the more often you watch them, you see more things in them. Kane, I've lost count how many times I've seen that, but it's still wonderful to watch. But you see Ambersons over and over again, and it's a different experience every time. And a friend of mine, Roger Ryan, did his own reconstruction of Ambersons with stills and people reading the dialogue that's missing and the music from Bernard Herrmann that's missing. And it's amazing. It's a very different film,
yeah.
What Welles originally envisioned. And that is not available commercially, but there was some talk they might put that out on the DVD with Ambersons, and then they got too cheap to do it. But maybe someday that'll be seen. Maybe we'll find the missing Ambersons, too.
Yes. Here's hoping.
I mean, the original version of The Passion of Joan of Arc was found in a Danish mental hospital.
Right.
So strange things keep popping up, you know.
That's true.
So I'm going to find, well, at least I'll try to find the missing Ambersons. And I want to make a documentary about my search for it. So just searching for it is important.
Absolutely.
Even if we don't find all these things.
Exactly.
But in the meantime, also read all these books that are coming out. As I mentioned, Pat McGilligan's Young Orson and Josh Karp's book called Orson Welles' Last Movie. It's about the other side of the wind. These are going to be terrific books.
Okay. Excellent. That's The Way We Frame It, FlixWise, that is. If you're interested in learning more about Orson Welles' later work, you can pick up a copy of Joe's book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career. And for a more comprehensive discussion of Welles' work, you can listen to our Sunset Boulevard podcast, which was released in January of this year. On that episode, the professor and I take a broader view of Welles' work, and it is available on, you guessed it, iTunes. And while you're there, you might as well give us a 5-star review. Tell Apple how much you like FlixWise. And by extension, Orson Welles. You do like Orson Welles, don't you? If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave us a note on our website, FlixWise.com. You can also find us at Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. You can follow me on Twitter, at FlixWise. Until next time, Professor, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful podcast you do, and I'm proud of you and appreciate everything you do, and I'm always thrilled to be back.
Oh, wonderful. It's always such a pleasure. And happy birthday, Orson.
Yes, Reed.